came to them and they'd say, oh, I feel so depressed, what should I do?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that they didn't feel dismay or disappointment or hopelessness. They just didn't have the word for it.
Yes, so what happens to that concept if you don't have a word for it?
It gets worked through or worked out, or it doesn't, in a variety of other ways. Probably that doesn't include therapy.
Be out of a job.
No money to be made.
It's their problem.
Yeah, that's interesting though, isn't it? If you don't see it as depression as something solid, then the way you relate to it is very different.
Yeah, but in Japan, there's been a denial of psychological illness for a very long time. It's just changing recently, but that didn't stop people from jumping in front of drains.
Yeah, but denial implies the concept, doesn't it? You know and you deny it. Whereas in the Tibetan scheme of things,
it's
more like pre-concept.
It led to a lack of options and the lack of ability to seek help, as a matter of fact.
I think the Tibetan system is really the opposite. There are lots of options for working with your mind.
Yes.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
You know? So then why would they have depression? There was no need for depression. They only saw depression after, I mean, talking to some of the lamas, they only saw depression after the Chinese communist regime came into Tibet. Yeah. Before that, they never really saw, they never really, you know, had people coming up to them. And,
that's what I'm trying to convey, is that from what I've read about Japan, there were deep levels of unhappiness and frustration and despair, but no language to talk about it. It didn't mean it wasn't there.
Well,
and with a language to talk about it, you can have more options.
I'm not so sure. I think with a language to talk about it, you can have less options.
Yes,
because
I agree.
Because that makes it solid, that defines it, that puts contours around it, I mean, I think that Tibetans certainly must have experienced a whole range of mental activity, the same range of mental activity we must experience, but not labeling it in the same way that we do. I mean, sometimes actually labeling it in different ways, maybe labeling it in terms of the way the airs in the body are moving or things like that.
Long label that way.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, certainly ways to deal with it in that way, even if not labeling it the same way we do.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say, is that what we later come to label with reference to a certain constellation of feeling and behavior can still exist without the label. That's all I'm saying. The label didn't create that constellation.
The label.
Thinking about disease.
Exactly. I'm just thinking about the disease, and
very.
The label doesn't create the disease. It's just a constellation. But I mean, in order for this constellation to be one thing, then the label is creating it. It's like
that's
a Big Dipper. Is a constellation, isn't it? And you have this star and this star and this star and this star and this star, right? So when I call it the Big Dipper, I am creating the Big Dipper because there ain't no dipper there. You know, it's just this star and this star and this star and this star, isn't it?
Well, there are certain constellations of behaviors and feelings and responses that typically slot into what has now been labeled X. And a different set of behaviors, etc.
But it's only the label. It's only the label that makes that. That's the point.
No.
Nah, that's where I don't accept that. The label does tend to limit it and tighten it, I agree.
It tightens it.
But
it allows you to articulate it in a different way. I mean, that's thinking back to George Orwell in 1984, and that's what the government did, was to take certain words out of the vocabulary so that people had a more difficult time articulating concepts the government did not want them to articulate in their own minds. So it does help to tighten things and give, and therefore potentially give voice to something. So, you know, if you think that depression is something concrete, you tend to think of yourself, you label yourself more often.
I am depressed.
I am depressed.
Yeah.
But it didn't create the depression, and it was, but it maybe allowed it you to tighten up the concept and articulate it to yourself as well as to others.
I think it did create the depression,
yes,
because it made the depression into a noun. It made,
yeah,
it made something that was a phenomenon.
Mm.
And it made something that was a process into to a thing.
Mm.
But the process was still there.
Well, the process was still there, but it wasn't a thing.
I don't know, I've seen on this point, in another example, you know, when I lived in Japan, there was a lot of what I saw labeling from the Western viewpoint as alcoholism.
Yeah.
And there was a deep social problem with that, but because there wasn't the language to, or the sort of like acknowledgement in a social way to sort of accept that fact, then a lot of people did sort of suffer in sort of eddies, tidal eddies, so to speak,
mm-hmm,
where the society wasn't able to cope with that because there was no real language to acknowledge it. So I think what I'm hearing is that, you know, you have to be careful the way the language is constructed. Depression has a certain definition, it has a certain social understanding, a context, and if it's described as something sort of permanent, etc., etc., then yeah, there will be consequences as a result. And this is the whole, isn't this Mahayana, like Vinyamika, where the language is constructed in a certain way, as Dzogchen Shense says, is that some concepts destroy other concepts,
mm-hmm,
whereas others, some other concepts
mm-hmm
do not.
Mm-hmm.
So those concepts which destroy concepts are sort of, you know, they could be, you might say, be beneficial in a societal context.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
When I first studied acupuncture in Korea many years ago, the first lesson, the teacher turned around to me and he said, there is no disease until we create it. Yeah, and it's the same thing. And when you give it a label, then it becomes a disease. Otherwise, it is not a disease. Yeah. And so, you know, the way they relate to the body is so different than our Western way of relating to the body, where everything, you know, this is this part, and this is, you know, this is like this, and they don't see it, how it all fits together, and the conditions that are necessary for you to experience things.
So if they have a malfunction within the body, how do they work with it?
They just see it as an energy, the energy is not flowing freely. Because when the energies are flowing freely, then everything functions. You know, the blood circulation functions.
And that's Chinese here too, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes,
but Chinese also had a whole range of labels for different conditions.
Yeah, they did. But they, you know, it's a different way of approach. I think, personally, I think the idea of depression has really created depression in many ways. Because if you just sit and you actually see, you just look at the conditions arising and passing away, there's nothing that you can call depression. But when you don't see, then immediately you solidify and you hold on to something.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to what you were saying before about how we grab onto a sense of self, how we create a sense of self.
Yeah.
Because depression is nothing more than obsessing about yourself feeling a certain way.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
you're powerless to feel any other way.
But if you don't have that strong sense of me, mine, going around and around all the time, then you're not going to get trapped in that cycle of psychology.
Yeah.
I agree that it's very dangerous because people who are clinically depressed are always fighting against people who just say, well, you're depressed in the everyday sense, and they're put down.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, all in the mind, kind of. I mean, if that's taken at that very kind of superficial level, clinical depression is something awful.
No, I'm not saying it's not.
And I'm not sure that it's within the ability of most people to deal with it by watching their mind.
In the Tibetan medical system, then they also, you know, again, as Rodney said, it's talked about as an imbalance in the ears. That's what causes schizophrenia. There's a blockage in the heart center. Now, we would never think that that was the cause of schizophrenia, but according to Tibetans, you know, the ears are blocking. They're not flowing through your heart chakra. And because of that, then your thought process becomes irrational. Because we don't understand that the thoughts ride on these ears. When the ears are calmed down, then the thought process calms down and cuts out eventually. Because the thought process is related to the eyes and the respiration. And this is why we do a lot of shamatha. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Because it calms down the ears, and then the thought process calms down, and eventually we begin to go beyond the thought process. We see the thought process for what it is, and then we're not trapped anymore by the thought process.
I suppose you could argue that some of the modern day psychotropics seek to achieve just that result.
Yes.
Different facts.
But it's not about blocking out anything. You know, this we may think that this is it's shutting out something, but it's not. It heightens the way that you see, because you see more clearly, more precisely. Now we see through clouds of endless filters of conditioning. We do not see clearly. We do not see precisely.
Well, what Nolly is talking about are people who don't share the illusion that the rest of us share. But they've got their own special.
Yeah, they've got their own special way of seeing.
we think that
they are. Mentally ill, and we think that we're not.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, who's to say? Just because we all agree on something.
We say they're crazy and we're not.
It's because there's more of us and less of them.
Right.
Yeah. If there was more of them.
I'm reading a book now that Stratterwell researched about the beginnings of psychology in the 1890s, and this guy named Charcot.
1890s, listen to
1860s, sorry, in France.
Not very old, is it?
The hypothesis about mental illness, especially with women, is really, it's disturbing to read. And this guy was just considered, Charcot was just considered the expert of the day, and what he said was considered so brilliant and insightful. It was just horrifying.
Right, horrifying.
Oh yes, and his views of women and hysteria, and there was one poor guy.
Only women get hysterical.
Just right. And there was one poor guy. It's all to do with menses, you know. One poor guy was hit by a car, and. Or hit by whatever he was hit by at the time.
Did the car exist?
Apparently not, because he got up and he was all right for a while. And then subsequently developed symptoms. And it never occurred to these people that he actually had a brain injury. You know, Charcot went on and on demonstrating with this guy how various elements of the mind and the psyche and so forth were leading to all these systems. It's just, how about his brain injured? It's just, and this was the thinking of the day. You know, the cutting edge thinking of the day.
Yeah, it's the same today, Melanie, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
it's the same today.
Yeah, exactly, I know.
When I go into some of these departments in the universities, yes, then wow, the views are so rigid. You know, I'm banned from certain universities. Because, yeah, seriously, I'm banned from teaching at the university because it conflicts with Freud's view. The way Freud sees things.
Anyway, really?
Many of the universities, many of the universities of Korea.
Behavioral, the same rigidity. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And many of the universities are only allowed, you can only pass if you've gone through the course of Freud's psychology, Freudian psychology.
So our group has to get bigger, is what you said?
Hmm?
Our group has to get bigger then.
Even Freud was going to be on Freud by now.
Thank you. Very good. Must write down some of these things. Even Freud. All right. So now what happens is we have a preoccupation with pleasure and pain. We have a preoccupation with wealth and poverty. Fame and obscurity, praise and blame, and this is all due to the idea of I. Without that, we just wouldn't be involved in all of this. Now, pain, we will understand more when we go into pain, how it works. Fascinating, you know, my first-hand experience is last 5 months of working with pain, sometimes unsuccessfully, I must say. And but it's been a great teacher. Nowhere to run, absolutely nowhere to run. Even the drugs, the heavy drugs, first-hand experience of heavy drugs, and they don't work. In the end, you just have to. To sit with it and really watch it, and slowly it dissolves. Believe it or not, if you can sit long enough, it does dissolve. It doesn't mean to say you shouldn't do anything about your condition, but it does, you know, just by sitting with it, it can appear in a very different way. But when you don't have the tolerance to sit with it, then it really does. It can really control you. Something you have to fight all the time. Helen Ma, who used to be one of our group, Dr. Helen Ma, she's giving a course. The hospital authority here in Hong Kong invited her to give a workshop on using meditation to deal with chronic pain. And this is really quite a shift in the way the hospital authority thinks. And so, you know, if anyone can attend, I don't know if it's open to other people, but she's been studying with, what's the guy's name from Massachusetts University?
Howard Zinn?
John Kabat-Zinn.
John Kabat-Zinn,
yeah. Yes.
John
Kabat-Zinn. Yeah. So she's really a very fine student.
Oh, she's doing the mindfulness-based stress
reduction?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's really spreading in Hong Kong. She's working with a lot of different groups of people.
So is
she
another...
Yeah, she's done a lot of practice. She really does a lot of retreats. And it's wonderful to see that it comes from practice. Not just intellectual, but really based in practice, this whole therapy.
Oh, lots of homework. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lots of homework.
Yeah, I've done the course. Yeah.
You've done the course. How much homework have you done?
Oh, you do it every night. Yeah, every day.
Every day.
Wow.
Every month. Yeah. Very helpful. Many different approaches. You know, nobody's saying there's just one approach. But when we listen to these teachings, it opens us to different approaches, you know, so that we can be more tolerant to other people's views. Not just my way of seeing things, but, you know, there are different ways of seeing. Now, why are there different ways of seeing? Why should I think I'm right and you're wrong? Why? we do constantly, and this is what causes us so much stress, so much aggravation. Always, I'm right and you're wrong. Okay, this week, let's look at this week alone. How many of us have gone through this? I'm right and you're wrong. Thank you. Yeah. You know, these teachings are about our life. It's not something abstract. It's about the way we experience life. So then what made you feel I'm right and you're wrong?
Fear.
Fear, okay. Good. Fear. Insecurity. Anybody else? I'm right and you're wrong.
But it changes. Every day it changes. And your attitude shifts according to how you feel. And your whole idea of what truth was changes.
Sometimes there's a kind of I'm right that is right in a particular situation. I mean, like, I'm just thinking about observing a new teacher.
Hmm.
I know that I'm right in some of the observations I made simply because she doesn't have the experience to see how to do it properly. I mean, I'm talking about techniques, you know, teaching techniques and so on. So in that, I mean, how does that fit in? Because it's not saying, you know, you're an awful person or you're stupid. It's just
I think that's it. There's no problem in that. That doesn't cause aggression.
I guess as long as you don't do it.
It comes from wisdom. It comes from understanding. It should come from that openness of, you know, listening to somebody, really listening. Then, if you're really listening, then you should know how to help that person. You can communicate to that person. But if you're not listening, then it's I'm right and you're wrong and that's it.
So many correlations in between, it's sometimes hard to tell which is which. You think you're being right because you're right.
Yeah. You've got to have a lot of reference points, haven't you, to be right? I'm right. What does it mean unless you have all the reference points? I'm right because. You're wrong. Because. Got to make it solid, otherwise it doesn't work.
Yeah, but how do you draw the distinction between being a social activist, say? Or an example would be, although it's a bit past now, but the anti-smoking lobby. I mean, the lobby that was lobbying against Hong Kong going non-smoking. I have very personally firm position on that. And if people hadn't lobbied as weakly as they did lobby, I think what's been passed is pathetic, but it does affect people's health. I'm not making myself very clear on this, but there are very private views on this.
Yeah, but you don't, you know, there are different ways to approach things. Many different ways. If we don't have skillful means comes through seeing. And it doesn't come through not seeing. So we understand the conditions. We understand the conditions of smokers. Goodness me, I used to be such a heavy smoker. Yes, I go around smoking all the dog ends of everybody else. Yeah. 3 packs a day. When I was paralyzed, that was one way they got me to move, just putting the cigarettes just out of reach. You were allowed to smoke in the hospitals when I was a kid. 13 and a half, I was already a heavy smoker. My father used to give me a puff of his cigarette every Wednesday night when I was 7 years old.
Wow.
So that I wouldn't like smoking.
Gee.
Listen to this psychology. Every Wednesday night, one puff of his cigarette, so I wouldn't like the taste of the cigarette. So by 12, I was already smoking both dope and ordinary cigarettes. So then 13 and a half, I was paralyzed. And then the cigarettes were always put just out of reach, so that I would try everything to get to the cigarettes. Yeah, I know smoking. So, it's not a question of wrong, it's a question of yes, what makes that person, you know, have that kind of need, and how are we going to work with it?
I don't get it. I understand what you're saying. I used to be a heavy smoker too, but...
Yeah, but it's not a question of this idea of wrong and right. It's understanding what makes a person smoke and seeing how you can help them. Is it wrong?
No, that's not wrong. I help people quit smoking, for God's sake. It's not that. There's been a quote-unquote controversial issue in Wedgco about having restaurants, etc., go non-smoking. And there's been a very strong lobby against that. The modern view, the scientific evidence against passive smoke is huge. It's very strong. Passive smoke is very dangerous.
So what are we talking about here?
There are different views on this. And my question is, this seems to me a pretty black and white issue. You're either on one side or the other.
But it's the people who are most against this are the people who own the restaurants.
So what you're saying is that you're so sure
that you're so right to tell them what they ought to do in the restaurant that they own. That's what you're saying. You're saying it's so black and white. But for them, it's all so black and white. They're saying, it's my restaurant.
But it hurts people.
Yeah, well, if they don't want to come to my restaurant, they don't have to come. You see what I'm saying? I'm not taking their side, but I'm saying, you know, for them it just seems so clear as well, you know, so black and white as well. You know, it's my restaurant. You don't want to come and inhale the smoke in my restaurant? You don't have to come. Yeah.
Well, they're betting that more people will continue to come and smoke.
Yeah.
You want to learn.
Exactly.
But my question is that this, to me, is, as you're saying, it's quite a black and white issue. I'm very, you know, one-sided about it, obviously. So, when you have these kinds of dichotomies, how, and this is a pretty good example actually, how do you work with it to end up with, there isn't, from what I understand, there's really no compromise for the health of non-smokers. So, how do you work with it?
By understanding. By understanding, you really will have a way of working with it. We can look at the situation here with the government in many different ways. Of course, they're ignoring environmental issues and whatever. Why are they ignoring this? Because of self-interest. It all comes down to self-interest. So we understand that, you know, what makes this self-interest is the same as us being concerned with certain things. It's not a question of right or wrong, it's a question of how the psychology works, understanding that, and then, you know, with that understanding, without the aggression, then, you know, introducing a different way of thinking about things. You don't have to have the aggression.
You can have the rigid thinking without
the rigid way. Well, what you're calling aggression, I mean, yes, there is anger, and this is part of
it. Yeah,
you know,
it comes back on us.
Too. But there still is this idea of action, whether it's, I consider it more moral to fight with regard to the smoking issue, or in my case, it's more this stuff out here that we're all involuntarily breathing. But the government says it's perfectly okay for us, and it's not. There's also the matter of Tibet being part of China, and China's actions, presumed freedom of action that gives them. can we be, do we need to be indifferent? Well, should we be indifferent to those things?
There's no indifference. I don't see it as indifference.
I think the biggest danger is to think that you're better than them. Mm. Yeah,
yeah.
That's the biggest danger. You think, you know, you think you're so smart, right? And they're so bad, and they're so immoral, and you're the moral one. That's where the problem is.
Well,
I mean, to think that they're doing something that's not beneficial, and you would rather them do something that's beneficial, and you want to do what you can to urge them to or help them to do things that are more beneficial, that's one thing. But to think that you're good and they're bad, that's the big problem.
Well, what I would say is that
I would never think.
Maybe they're not inherently bad, but their actions, I believe that their actions are wrong because of the harm that is being done. And I consider it, in a sense, my obligation to stand up and to object to that.
But not out of anger.
Right, it can be
a sense of injustice.
Okay, although, that's why it should be. Sometimes anger gets into it.
Right. But I think it even makes it easier for you to do something positive about it if you first acknowledge those parts of yourself that might do the same thing, that might act in the same way, that might, you know what I mean?
That's just fine.
Yeah.
I think you can also recognize that the Chinese have a very good case. You may not agree with it, but the Chinese have a very good case in Tibet. There is a good case for Tibet being part of China. There is a good case.
Yeah.
You know, and you can recognize that without necessarily betraying your own principles.
I think
it's not black and
white.
No, these things are not black and white.
I mean, I found from my experiences with Amnesty that actually one of the consulates that will talk to us, which is the consulate of a repressive regime, would be counterproductive to be totally hostile with that person who is a sensible, nerve-wracking diplomat who will blow whichever way the wind blows, pressing always the winning side. His attitude is reasonably positive because, we sort of say what we think but give him kind of face and, in some ways.
Yeah.
Well, at least, you behave like a polite human being. So you can't deny what they're doing. I mean, it's counterproductive sometimes to be totally.
I'll give you an example. I worked in a Khmer Rouge camp. Now, anybody who knows anything about the Cambodian situation, as soon as they hear Khmer Rouge, everyone, atrocities and terrible and this, that and the other. But there I was, 36,000 people, Khmer Rouge camp. But those same people, you just gave them the opportunity to see things in a different way, They were totally, open to something else, but they were forced to act that way. They were forced to kill each other, The children were forced to kill their parents. You don't know what went on there. But then when the conditions changed, it wasn't like that anymore. Those same people, were beautiful, open, friendly, kind, generous, incredibly generous people. I used to walk around the camps in the morning, and they were threatened. Those same people were threatened by the leaders. If you offer food, if you talk to her, we'll do something to you or whatever. We'll stop the food coming into the camp. You won't get any food. And the old people who recognized the ropes, they prostrated in the mud when I came into the camp. I couldn't believe it. The tears were pouring down my face. I'd never seen anything like it. All these old people just out there lying in the mud, paying respect to me as I walked through the camp. And against their own threat of their own lives, they came out in the morning with the little bit of food that they had, and they would offer me some of this food. Each person, thousands of people, had all these little kids behind me with buckets, and I only had one bowl, and people kept putting food in the bowl, and it filled up, and then I put it into the bucket, and And then I had all this, like 20 or 30 kids with buckets walking behind me with all this food carrying it in. And then we'd meet underneath this little shelter that we'd made. And then I'd share all the food with everybody. And you just couldn't believe these were the same people who were committing all these atrocities 1 month before that. So, you know, it's not a question of right or wrong. When conditions change, then the way we see things also change. And that same person that you hated could be your best friend.
So, in that case, though, if you take Cambodia as the example, what about people like Duke, who've been under trial for so many years? I mean, do you think people should forgive and forget, or that they should receive justice for what they did?
Well, look how Mandela handled things.
That's a good effect. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's been a lot of criticism of that, because a lot of people say, well, you know, okay, maybe this isn't a Buddhist argument, maybe this is something slightly different, but if people believe that they can get away with it, I mean, if people see that even many years afterwards somebody comes after you and puts you on trial, then maybe it stops others.
That's the argument for the death penalty as well, isn't
yeah.
it?
No, not the death penalty, necessarily. The death
isn't
penalty,
it?
The death penalty doesn't act as a deterrent.
Well,
no,
maybe the Nuremberg trial wouldn't have acted as a deterrent for the Nazis either. You know what I mean?
Well, people were hungry after Nuremberg, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But, I mean, no, I'm talking about justice. I mean, for people to see that, you know, justice is eventually very quickly and slowly done.
But I still think the death penalty is a good analogy, because, I mean, the reason why the death penalty is not a deterrent is that when people are doing stuff, they don't think they're going to get caught, you know. And they may not even think that what they're doing is particularly wrong.
It's an interesting thing, because in East Timor, again, they're not pursuing people, whereas, you know, in Cambodia they have done. They have been trying to do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Mandela example is a good example, because that's a middle way. It's not a matter of not pursuing people. They did. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So, I mean, they did have trials. It had two parts. The first part was the truth part. That is, they did have trials, and everyone had to come and tell their stories, and you know, the people who were the victims and the people who were the perpetrators were required, basically, to come and tell the stories. There was the truth part. But then the second part is the reconciliation part. And say, okay, now we've gotten all the stories out, and so nobody was imprisoned for things that they did, or punished for things that they did.
But then what it means is that you get away with it if it was in that time, but then if you commit the same murders afterwards, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no equality for the same crime, and there's no equal justice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of an issue.
Yeah, this is a very good question. I'm glad this came up.
Mm. Because you can, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, there's a question of revenge, but which is not perhaps so productive, but it's a question of, yeah, justice.
Well, you look at the way His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, you know, his approach to the Chinese.
Yes.
If we hadn't have done something, we wouldn't have experienced this. If we hadn't created the conditions, we wouldn't have experienced this. And that's, he asked his people not to fight. Don't create more karma, more causes for more suffering. Many people died. Many people are still suffering. But this was his way of dealing with it. Don't create the conditions for more suffering. Hard for us to see that. Everything that we experience in each moment of our lives is because we created conditions. Otherwise, we wouldn't experience it that way. All these seeds of every experience are within your own consciousness. There's nothing new. Nothing new. Just the way you interpret things constantly. Whatever arises, seen through your own perception. It's seen through your own way of interpreting it to be a certain way.
I read something horrifying in the paper today. It really stunned me. Apparently in the U.S., some video came out that cost $20 to make, portraying bombs, homeless people and crippled people being beaten up and some killed. This video was sold for $1.5 million, I don't know where, to whom. And it's been widely broadcast, and there is now an enormous increase of teenagers harming, attacking, assaulting, and killing homeless people and crippled people for the fun of it. This is so beyond my... I mean, what kind of a society is creating people that find this attractive?
Confused.
Yeah. And, of course, I don't know anything about the demographics of the kind of kids who are actually doing this as opposed to...
No, it doesn't matter, Melanie. It doesn't matter. It just shows you how confused we all are. In the city where I lived in Brazil, where I first went to live in Brazil, Maceió, I went to one children's project. I think I told you this. And there were pictures of all these different children on the wall who this man had helped. And I said, well, this is wonderful. And he said, yes, but he said two-thirds of them are dead. He said, I had to make a choice. He said, whether I gave $5 for the food for the ones who were living or $5 for a little pluck for the ones who were killed. So the policy of the police was to go around killing all the children who were involved in theft, who lived on the streets. And this was the policy. 4,000 children were killed in 1 year. I have all the statistics of what, you know, what they were. So, you know, we're talking about confusion in general. We can pick up different elements of confusion. Some will horrify us more than others. We can talk about environmental issues, or we talk about whatever, Cambodia, this, that, and the other. But it all stems from a confused mind. We are so confused. And unless we work with our confusion, there is no way that we can really benefit others. I'm talking about long-term benefit, not just short-term benefit. Yes, we can give somebody a massage, and that really eases the discomfort. But
you've
got to work
okay.
with it.
All right, you say confusion, but these teenagers that are so bereft of their own humanity that they would be picking on such people for the thrill of it.
It's happening in Hong Kong too. I mean, it's not uncommon for homeless people
to
be beaten up.
Yes, it's not uncommon. Sorry, I can't hear.
We live in a culture that if you turn on the television, it's all about the most awful kind of crime that you can imagine.
Yes.
Very little positive or
yes.
life-enhancing stuff that we're being exposed to.
Yes. Usually when it's in kitsch, you know, kitten saved, that kind of thing.
Nothing new. I mean, people, human beings have slaughtered each other in huge wars for thousands of years. You know, it's nothing new.
In the hospital, then in the evening when I waited for my drip, I was exposed to the television. So then I would sit there and watch some of the programs, and I had never seen, you know, just violence, incredible violence, and violence upon violence, and violence upon violence.
The most vulnerable people as well, violence against your children or women, or it just seems to be...
Black humor. Yes, very. I thought, my goodness.
And even the whole Halloween thing is incredible. I mean, when you see how people are celebrating violence and gore.
And people don't realize what they're celebrating, though, in general. It's just another excuse for a party. It's like us. We're having a party tonight. Probably why most people came today, because we have a film and a party afterwards. I'm joking.
Not
yeah.
Movie.
You're right.
Sorry.
Yeah. So you see, you know, the point is from the moment you walked in today until this moment now, our perception is changing. We're listening to things, we're considering different ideas, and then our own ideas are also changing. And then we go out and we share a different way of seeing with other people. I think this is fascinating how the mind works. That we can really create the way we see life. Up to us. The ball is passed back to us. We can't blame anybody for the way we feel. We can't depend on anybody for the way we feel. We have to take responsibility for the way that we feel about everything in our life. If we understand these teachings, if we don't understand these teachings, then we will go back to our old habit patterns of blaming someone, blaming the situation, blaming anything. The weather, the this, the that, constantly, you know, that's, oh, I feel so bad because never, you know, looking back at how we're creating the situation. Because our habits don't allow us. We're just pulled back into the old habits of objectifying the cause out there. Something there that's causing this unpleasant feeling. Isn't it like that? It's so hard to change. But we can change. That's the beauty of it. We can. But it takes training. It takes mental training. Familiarizing yourself again and again and again with another way of seeing. Well, I haven't actually started. This is just the introduction, but you get the feeling of the teaching. We're really going to look at experience, how it works. And I hope you'll be patient enough not to just judge things too quickly, but to, you know, sit with it. And, and maybe we can just sit for a while now. And we can put the movie on or whatever, and the food, a cup of tea. So, Eric and I were talking last night, and I said, you know, I'd like to introduce sitting by just helping you appreciate, or helping ourselves appreciate, this what I call baby-like attitude. So, if you put a baby in here and you put it on the floor, then the baby doesn't say or think to itself, what a nice tonker, I like that. Or, you know, oh, I don't like those colors, or I don't like that person. No, the baby doesn't have any ideas about anything. So then how does the baby see if the baby has no ideas? So when we sit, you know, if we want to just sit in a very kind of fresh, open way, then we just relax and just let go of all these ideas. Just, you know, whatever comes, just let it come and just don't try to do anything. Just see how it arises. As it arises, whatever it is, whatever the feeling, it will arise and pass away. Arise and pass away. Arise and pass away. So fast. Moment by moment, moment by moment. Yeah. And this is what we're doing. Just, we're seeing that, you know, it's more like a stream of consciousness. It's not a thing. It's a stream constantly changing, fresh, each moment. Yeah. And we just need to relax more. Just let whatever come and go, come and go. That's meditation. Don't have to do anything. Just sit, relax, let go. Notice that it's only when your mind lingers or rests on anything that actually the thing arises. When we don't rest on anything, then it's just a flow. Very open, very spacious. for people who are just beginning to sit, then keep your practice very short, you know, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 30 seconds, it doesn't matter, but just rest your mind, let it just feel this open freshness, baby-like attitude, a minute here, a minute there, all through the day, and just rest. And then slowly you can introduce it more and more. Don't make your practice into a duty, something heavy. Keep it light. And just rest a little, and then again. People say to me, oh, I can't practice, I don't have time. But life itself is practice. You can't separate your life from your practice. It's not like, you know, oh, I'm going to go to the temple on some Sundays, or church on whenever, synagogue on Saturdays. It's not like that. Just moment by moment, you just rest. See what's happening. In the beginning, I think, you know, just observe how everything is changing moment by moment. Just how things arise, pass away. And that helps you relax. Otherwise, in the beginning, just to relax, it's hard. But one familiarizes oneself with the flow, changing phenomena. And then one sees one can't manipulate or control things any longer. That's the way it is. Constantly changing. Nothing solid. You do the dedication, and we'll do the long life prayer of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. You should include that in your dedication, and Tilly Norma Rinpoche's long life. You know that? And Brother Kenzie's long life.